Dr. Paul here. Welcome to another episode of Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. Today's episode, you're going to hear my interview with one of my heroes, Dr. Jim Meehan. This man was at West Point Military Academy, Oklahoma Medical School, was the associate editor of Ocular Immunology and Inflammation. He's had over a decade in functional medicine. He has treated over 1,000 COVID patients. He's a warrior from the battlefield and now a warrior in the COVID crisis. And we are going to talk about masks. We're going to talk about the COVID-19 vaccines. We're going to talk about Tony Fauci and the gain of function research that he was involved with way back when. And we're going to talk about vaccine injuries. I then share with you an interview that's going to touch you to the core, touch you in your heart. Just now, interviewing a young man, well, maybe not super young, but he's a whole lot younger than I am, physician's assistant, PA Scott Miller. He has a huge practice in Vancouver, battleground area here in southern Washington. He has treated 1,400 COVID patients, and just last night gets a letter from the medical board that he cannot practice medicine any longer because he is a threat to public health. Here's a man who is literally running into burning buildings, saving lives, keeping people out of the hospital, and has saved over 1,398 patients. A true hero, sidelined. You're gonna hear that story. Do not miss this show. Watch it all the way through. Enjoy the show. I'm Dr. Paul. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My topic for today is fear. Now, fear is something that can devastate you. It can incapacitate you. It can just stop you dead in your tracks. You don't even know which way to turn, what to do, and you become so immobilized that you just look for any sort of relief from that fear. And I have a feeling that many of us have undergone this fear story this past 18 months with what's happened with COVID-19. Maybe you're still afraid. What I wanted to share with you today is that there's a difference between having concern or being so fearful and worried that you're anxious out of your mind, or so anxious that you're probably harming your own immune system and you're maybe no longer able to really think clearly and process information in a way that's truly healthy and helpful to you. So let's be concerned about what's going on with regards to COVID-19, what's going on with regards to our loved ones, and everything that's going on in our world. But let's not be fearful. Well, Dr. Paul, how do I do that? My mom is in an institution where everyone's vaccinated. No visitors are allowed in if they're not vaccinated. Everybody's wearing masks and social distancing. I was driving to work this past week and passed a group of school children. They were about 5, 6, 7 age group, all wearing masks, socially distanced by 6 feet. And looking in the eyes of some of these kids, and you could just see the lights were gone. And then I saw this in the eyes of this other little kid. He was like, he was there. He was almost like, help. It just felt, I'm a pediatrician. I have children. It just feels so wrong. I mean, for kids to be raised covered in masks, they're not expressing their emotions. And this is all over a virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, that is virtually harmless to children. Now, don't get me wrong. If you are high risk and you're in your late 80s, 90s, 100 years old, and you get this virus, it can be deadly, although even for you, armed with the right information of how to boost your immune system, it's actually not that scary, even for the highest risk people. So yes, we're having reports of vaccine injury exceeding 16,000 in the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. We also have countries around the world that are doing amazingly well. In fact, those countries that are less vaccinating now having better and better results. We're having individuals recover from COVID at lightning speed by instituting some of the treatments that are now available that we talk about in this show all the time. So I'm bringing you really a message of hope that you don't need to live in fear. Sure, be concerned, be discerning, inform yourself. Information empowered with the right knowledge of what to do and what you don't need to be afraid of is absolutely freeing. I travel around the country and rub elbows with people, we hug, we don't wear masks, and we are all doing just fine, thank you. I'm over 60 years old, I am not vaccinated, and I am not fearful. How could that be? If you are optimizing your immune system with healthy whole foods, you've got an optimal vitamin D by supplementing extra vitamin D, and you're reducing fear, you're reducing stress, you're living healthfully, sleeping well, getting outside, getting sunshine, living in community with people who love you, hugging people, taking your mask off every chance you get if you're in one of those situations, like I'm in a state that has a lot of masking mandates, and so we wear them in certain situations just out of respect for those who are so fearful. But really, you can have an amazing life going forward. Let's put fear aside, embrace faith and love, and link arms with our fellow human beings who are like-minded. I'm Dr. Paul. Welcome, Dr. Jim Meehan. You are such a dear friend of mine. We've spoken together at a number of conferences around the country. You did serve in the military, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I went to medical school in Oklahoma, but I did my residency training at Washington University in St. Louis, and then chief resident ophthalmology department at John Cochran VA. Great medical school, great training. Very good
folks,
experience.
To be a chief resident, you are at the top of your class. That is not an easy position to obtain. This man is brilliant. You've now, in addition to having been associate editor of Ocular Immunology and Inflammation, a very important magazine in your world at that time, you're now have over a decade in functional medicine and immunology. And you've really dedicated the past couple years to helping people with COVID. So I know, having been a warrior on the battlefield, you're now a warrior on the battlefield that we're all facing here in this country and in this world.
Yeah. Same battlefield that, by the way, and thank you for all of that. You honor me greatly, but you know, I want to honor you for a little bit because you've been a hero of mine. You know, I always say it, some of the bravest people in medicine are pediatricians that wake up and fight against many of the causes that you have been fighting against for so long. And so I honor you, Paul Thomas, and you are a dear friend because you have an amazing heart.
Well, thank you, Jim. And I admire you too. You have the courage to tackle a very, very important and difficult situation for many, many people. And it's not without risk. And what you do is not without risk either. And so the brave physicians who step forward and are willing to take a chance and do the right thing, you're right at the top of my list of heroes. You have right on your website an emergency declaration. Are you willing to tell the world what that is?
Well, that emergency declaration really came out as we were starting to see, and I was increasingly seeing patients being injured by these COVID-19 vaccines that, and it was in a younger population. In fact, a lot of college age individuals were being coerced and forced by their universities to get vaccinated. And shortly within, 72 hours of vaccination, they start developing, vasculitis, all kinds of inflammatory pathologies, clot formation. Research was starting to demonstrate that the spike protein by itself, and even the subunit, the S1 subunit of that spike protein, which our cells were being reprogrammed to produce. The mRNA vaccines are not really a vaccine. That's a misnomer. It's a mislabel to take advantage of the liability immunity that many vaccines have been granted since 1986 in children's vaccines. But certainly in the COVID-19 vaccines, they got a blank check to experiment on the population with untested, unsafe potentially dangerous vaccines that we had no long-term data on. And their independent research scientists were showing that these spike proteins were in and of themselves capable of binding to the ACE2 receptors and stimulating the same pathology that the virus in its entirety would be able to induce. So we were programming people's cells in to produce these spike proteins. We were being told, hey, don't worry about it. It'll stay in the arm. It will, you know, the cells will produce it for a short period of time. They'll be translocated to the MHC receptor and presented by MHC, major histocompatibility complexes, where the immune cells would come trolling by, see it and create antibodies. And, well, you know, we'll have a great vaccine. Well, all of those lies were, you know, being demonstrated to be to be lies as science was showing, man, these spike proteins, when you take these spike proteins and you inject them into animals, you get a disease process that looks exactly like an infection by COVID-19. You get these spike proteins opening up the brain barrier, the blood brain barrier, which is a really important barrier that protects the brain from environmental toxins and inflammatory damage. So you had a two hit hypothesis here that I was, you know, putting together and trying to warn everybody that had signed up for my newsletter. And I put it on social media, which got me banned from kicked off Twitter, kicked off Facebook. When I present the peer reviewed science, this is what happens. But I was putting together the situation, and I wasn't alone. There were other doctors that were doing it. And I think it was other doctors that were putting the pieces together at the same time. So I stand on the shoulders of giants. But the ability of this spike protein to bind to the ACE2 receptors, to create that inflammatory cascade, to create a clotting disorder, to also open up the blood-brain barrier and introduce this inflammatory damage to the brain, which I had several patients. I think I had four at the time that after vaccination, they had disabling headaches. For one was I'll never forget, 43-year-old nurse. Well, I won't forget her because she's still a patient. 43-year-old nurse gets vaccinated and with a Moderna vaccine. First dose was bad, but she was being coerced by her hospital, gets a second dose. And after the second dose, the headaches became unrelenting. And it's been now 13 weeks of disabling headaches. She's completely disabled, has gone through, you know, every imaging study that you can get trying to, trying to uncover what's going on, what's causing these disabling. But really what she will report is the doctors are trying to find, you know, they're trying to find everything but the real cause. The cause was the vaccine. It's so clear. And that combination of those two emergency declared clinical studies that I reported on are exactly what's happening in a large percentage of the population, Paul.
Yeah.
And I'm very concerned about it.
Yeah, no, I share your concern. So in a couple sentences, what do you tell families about giving this vaccine to their children or taking it when you're pregnant?
Oh, yeah. Well, children in particular, it's we must not vaccinate children that are statistically zero risk of dying from COVID-19. You know, there's been it's less than 300 children in the United States that have died of COVID-19. All of those based on a Johns Hopkins analysis by Marty Makary of Johns Hopkins, 45,000 children studied that had got COVID-19. None of them died of COVID-19. He also analyzed the 251 some odd children that had reported to have died of COVID-19 in the United States. And all of them, 100%, had severe, significant immunosuppressive disease of one form or another, leukemias, cancers.
Conditions.
Yeah. So they're very, you know, very susceptible to any pathogen on the planet. So you have a population that is statistically zero risk of dying of COVID-19. And then we're going to vaccinate them with an experimental technology that's still to this day only under experimental use authorization. Comirnaty, the FDA approved version, is not being produced yet. It has not been deployed. So they're all under experimental use. And you and I both know vaccines take a long time to manifest their long-term adverse effects. Yeah. We don't have that long. You can warp speed a lot of things and cut a lot of shortcuts. But one thing you cannot shortcut is you cannot shortcut the time it takes for these immune dysregulating or altering vaccines to manifest the unexpected consequences of their experimental nature.
I mean, so I have 10,000 patients approximately under my care with my team here at Integrative Pediatrics. I have not been giving the vaccine, but some kids have slipped off and gotten it. If they're over 12 years of age, they can go to a pharmacy and just get it. So of those 10,000 patients, I haven't had a single patient end up in the ER or the hospital with COVID. Yeah. I have had one child hospitalized. Guess what? It was one of those kids who got the vaccine and they were hospitalized for myocarditis.
Right.
And it absolutely, you're spot on. It makes zero scientific sense. It's insanity to be vaccinating children. And yet they're rolling this out as if it's a wonderful thing. Oh, look, it's now being approved down to age five potentially. And
yeah.
What about pregnancy?
Oh yeah. I mean, the first thing is we should be making policy and guiding, you know, recommendations for any medical intervention based on scientific research. Pregnant women were not a part of the preclinical trials. They're zero. We have a number of studies now that have shown a significant risk of miscarriage. The number of miscarriages in the open VAERS or the VAERS vaccine adverse event reporting system are very concerning. No, I would not recommend this vaccine for pregnant women. No way. Not a chance. We don't have the data on it. And there's too much evidence that spike protein, you know, the placenta is another ACE2 receptor rich environment. There's other mechanisms as to why this vaccine, these spike proteins being manufactured by your cells could damage the fetus, damage the placenta. In fact, Paul, I'll tell you that I've reviewed a couple of cases, pathology reports from a miscarriage, and I'm traumatized by what I read in the study and the pictures that I saw. The fetus was rendered a bloody mess, split in half, malformation in the neural tube. We simply cannot be vaccinating pregnant women.
I want to pivot to masks. I was on your website and I saw you have, I think it's a 52-page document on masks. You've got to be one of the world's leading experts on masks, whether or not they work. Give us the lowdown on masks.
Yeah, masks don't work, Paul. We have 100 years of science that have clearly said masks don't work. They're ineffective. They're unnecessary. You know, we don't have asymptomatic transmission. That's been thoroughly debunked by a number of studies now. That was one of the pretenses for wearing a mask. You know, this is the first experiment in the history of medicine where we've asked healthy people to wear masks. And the reason that we've never done it before is because we've actually have a huge body of science that says, well, when we've done high level evidence, randomized controlled trials and meta-analyses of multiple randomized controlled trials, we have always found that small respiratory viruses like influenza are not mitigated by the mask, but wearers are often harmed by the wearing of it. You know, so in medicine, we use this hierarchy of medical evidence. At the top of the pyramid are the meta-analyses of multiple randomized controlled trials. And randomized controlled trials is here. So this is multiple randomized controlled trials. So this stuff is policy grade. This is we can make decisions with. You know, I did my analysis, you can find on my website. I did a big analysis, 52 some odd pages, of all of the high-level science that say masks are ineffective, unnecessary, and harmful. And I debunked the low level studies that our CDC have been using to put our children in masks, put the population in masks. And I think that the science is overwhelming. And I don't think that our public health agencies are incompetent. I really, you know, come to the conclusion they're malevolent, that they are literally forcing upon and perpetrating on the population a intervention that they know doesn't work. We have you know, we have randomized controlled trials in the Netherlands that show that masks don't work in a population of 6,000 people. Half wear masks, half don't. Month later, they both got infected at statistically the same rate. So the first premise I would present to your listeners is there's not much that we can do to mitigate viral transmission in the population. The virus does what the virus is going to do. You can lock down all you want. You can mask all you want. The infectious disease curves all over the world have stayed pretty consistent. You know, it rises, it falls, and it has nothing to do with masks and lockdowns and even vaccines. So when you know, what the CDC likes to do is they like to do a study where they start here and they end here, and they're in the natural decline. The virus is doing what it's going to naturally do, but they'll create a study that captures a window. I call it the fallacy of the time window. And they'll try to contrive a narrative that says, see, masks did that. It's kind of like claiming that you're riding a bike down a hill and you want to claim that, and you put a mask on as you're going down that hill, and you want to claim that the mask is why you're gaining speed as you're going downhill. You're not controlling for gravity. It's not the mask. Rational Ground has done a big analysis where they've looked at the infectious disease curves throughout the world, different states, different countries, and they've mapped out where, you know, the various interventions like lockdowns or masks were started, and it doesn't change anything. Often what you'll see is when you have these little hard mask interventions, let's look at California. When they, my belief is that masks are increasing disease severity in the population. If you think about the nature of viral replication in the lungs, how our lungs are an excretory organ system. Let me take the screen share off here. But if you think about the danger of putting a barrier over your respirations when your lungs are trying to remove those viral particles, if you put a mask over your mouth when you're infected with COVID-19, you are going to make the disease much more severe and maybe even lethal, because you are increasing viral load. Viral load is a consistent principle of infectious disease virology throughout time. The more viral particles that have access to your tissues, the more severe the disease will be. Even a healthy individual can have their immune system overwhelmed by rebreathing those viral particles that are being caught on the inside of the mask.
Think about this. There are states that have no mask mandates, where there are stadiums full of spectators for, you know, professional sports, for example. And then there are other states where you're all masked up, and there's really no discernible difference in the outcomes. So that should tell you something. Just use your little common sense meter. I'm going to have you touch on one more controversial topic. It shouldn't be controversial. I think we know enough now, but this one's always seems to be controversial. Our dear Tony Fauci and the U.S. Funded gain of function research. I know you have some thoughts about this. Most people haven't looked into it really. They just sort of take the sound bites. Oh, that's a conspiracy theory or whatever. No. Can you shed some light on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I've done a great deal of research on this issue. You know, Anthony Fauci funded the gain of function research in Wuhan, China, together with Ralph Baric. U.S. citizens, agents of the United States government that have been participating in funding gain of function research in China, because most of the world agreed in 2014 that manipulating the viruses, animal viruses, bat viruses, manipulating them and inducing changes, gene splicing and introducing elements into a coronavirus, like the furin cleavage domain that was inserted into the genomic structure of the beta coronavirus family that was infecting bats. That's what they did in Wuhan, China. That if we do that kind of thing, we could create a lethal virus that could decimate the human population. That the risk of doing that kind of research, and, you know, and the pretense is we want to kind of create these viruses so we can create a vaccine, or we can have some kind of a plan should this emerge naturally in the environment. So we they're trying to kind of get ahead of nature. Well, don't try to get ahead of nature. Don't create these human engineered lethal viruses. And the world agreed on that in 2014, but China didn't. They weren't a part of those accords and those agreements. We were doing that gain of function research here in the United States in North Carolina under the research direction of Ralph Baric. And when the legislation and the agreement and the treaty to not do gain of function research hit ground here in the United States, what Fauci and Baric and others did is they exported it to China and continued the illegal research there. And what emerged from that laboratory, whether, you know, by accident or otherwise, is the virus that we are suffering with today. So we have absolute, and there's absolute evidence of it. You know,
there's a patent trail. I mean,
there's a patent trail. That's exactly right. People need to understand that they were patenting these viruses, years before they ever emerged here. The fact that Moderna, within 48 hours of the identification of the gene sequence in China being transmitted to the United States, had a vaccine ready. That's not possible, ladies and gentlemen. That's not possible. So do some research, because what you're hearing from the mainstream media and from people like Fauci, I mean, the fact that we are taking direction from the guy that funded the research, participated in it, and then tried to cover it up. That's the other thing. The Fauci email dumps, the Freedom of Information, revealing and exposing Dr. Fauci's email attempts to cover up the public awareness of this. That we found it all out. That guy is a criminal. He should be behind bars. He should not be giving us advice. He's been giving us the wrong advice throughout this pandemic. They're serving corporations. They're not serving public interest.
Yeah, no, absolutely. How do we help our loved ones, the American citizens, the citizens of the world, who are, I think, confused about what's going on because they're mostly listening to sound bites on news?
Yeah.
How do we break through that divide that's created between people such as yourself and I, who really have the science available to us, and people who are listening to sound bites as if they are truth?
We're at a very dangerous time in history, Paul, where pseudoscience and fraud are being perpetrated on the population. It's a time of, you know, psychological warfare on the human population, where they're not telling you just how many people are dying. They're even looking at the small fraction of those that are dying that is captured by the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS. And they're trying to say, oh, but that's not a reliable system. That is the system that was created by legislation. And it shows over 16,000 deaths. And that's a 1%. That's 1% probably of all the deaths that are happening out there. And the work of Dr. Jessica Rose and Steve Kirsch say it's at least 200,000 deaths. Yeah. And the mainstream media and the Faucis and the CDCs and the NIH, they're trying to sweep those deaths under the rug, but they're out there and your friends and family are experiencing them. And if you're trying to break through on someone, say, this could have been you, this could have been your child, this could have been your daughter, this could have been your father. You know, that's the only thing that I think will make a difference is these are experimental vaccines. It'll be a decade before we know how severe the adverse reactions are going to be. It's going to be years before we determine that, you know, we might lose 10% of the population to antibody dependent enhancement, something that was never figured out when we tried and failed to create vaccines for SARS-CoV-1 and MERS. We haven't figured this stuff out, folks, and they're lying to us. But you have a duty.
Yeah. So what do you, to pivot a little bit from that, one last thought I had, a mm-hmm. question for you. What do you say to the person that, you know, they sort of got pressured into getting the vaccine, right? They were going to lose their job, or what's happening with teenagers is it's peer pressure. I mean, immense right. peer pressure. Immense. So they've already taken one or two of the jabs. How do you help them sort of come to terms with that and maybe still be open to thinking differently going forward?
Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing is, you know, you love them. You got to love everybody. You got to love them anyway and say, look, I know you got pressured. The coercion, the psychological warfare is powerful. But now here's what we got to do. You need to learn that we've always had safe and effective treatments and preventatives for this disease. I've treated over 4,000 patients for COVID-19, you know, vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, quercetin, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, budesonide, fluvoxamine. We have a real armamentarium of treatments that could have been used and could have been far safer. You know, ivermectin is not just a horse dewormer. That's, again, the false narrative being tried, you know, trying to prevent public awareness of something that could prevent and even treat COVID-19. But because it's such a threat to the vaccine business model, they don't want you to know about it. But ladies and gentlemen, it is what I would take if I hadn't already had a day and a half mild course of COVID-19 early in the pandemic, because I was licking the doorknobs of every Walmart in Oklahoma trying to get the darn thing. I trust my immune system. I knew I would do fine with it. I knew how to treat it. So it's what I would take. It's in my medicine cabinet right now. Yeah. It's not a horse dewormer. It's a Nobel Prize winning therapeutic that blocks the SARS-CoV-2 virus from binding to the ACE2 receptor and about 16 other mechanisms of action. When we can protect those people that have been vaccinated from the possibility of antibody-dependent enhancement, or guess what, Paul? The vaccines aren't preventing infection or transmission. So we can also protect them from that possibility because, I mean, the breakthrough cases are ridiculous. I mean, the breakthrough cases are everywhere in the world. Most of the vaccinated, most of the hospitalizations in Israel now are in a heavily vaccinated population. I get it. So it's, you know, it's a proportion issue, but most of the hospitalizations and deaths in Israel right now are in fully vaccinated sometimes even four vaccines delivered, and they're dying of an infection from SARS-CoV-2 anyway.
Wow. I know I'm supposed to let you go, but I got one more question now.
I'm here as long as you need me, brother.
I'm talking to a guy, folks. We are listening to a man who has treated 4,000 patients for COVID. How many of your patients have ended up in the hospital? How many have died?
None have died. All of my patients have come to me early enough. Now I have helped. I've helped a lot that were in the hospital too, and everything was failing. And I give you a perfect example. 66-year-old male. Has a brain tumor. He's on a very powerful immunosuppressant. He gets COVID-19, spends 14 days in the hospital, gets two courses of remdesivir, which doesn't work. It's a dangerous medication. We eventually got him off isolation. The family started sneaking ivermectin up to this gentleman. And 3 days after starting ivermectin, he came off of high flow oxygen. The family was working hard to keep him from going to ventilator. He was at 95% high flow heated oxygen by nasal cannula, 95% oxygen, 95 liters per minute, Paul.
Wow.
3 days later, he walks out of the hospital after starting ivermectin. Now that's anecdotal, but listen, sure. I've got about 22 of those kind of stories.
Yeah. No, people like you who are treating appropriately, catching it early, but even if you're called in to 911, rescue somebody that's in trouble.
Yeah.
This is the story I'm hearing, folks. This is not a fatal disease when it's managed. If it's managed early and properly, it's no big deal at all.
But it's being mismanaged in hospitals, ladies and gentlemen. It's being mismanaged. Remdesivir is a failed antiviral. Should never have been used. Doesn't have the clinical science to support its use. In fact, the most recent studies show that not only does it not reduce mortality, it increases duration of hospitalization. Remdesivir doesn't work. Anemic levels of steroids. Steroids work, but they're giving too low of a dose of dexamethasone to alleviate the powerful cytokine storms. They need higher doses, and they really need a better steroid like methylprednisolone to alleviate that cytokine storm. And they definitely do not need mechanical ventilation. Mechanical ventilation just causes an ischemic reperfusion injury. It increases when you start pushing high pressures of oxygen into those lungs, that are most of the lung is being compromised because of microvascular clots. what it does is induces a bunch of free radical damage. And we're just mistreating it in hospitals. And the sad part of this is, I think some of it has to do with the incentives. You know, that there's still hospitals are still being awarded a $39,000 bonus for every patient that goes to mechanical ventilator. And I, you know, it's like Charles Munger said, famous economist, he said, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome. I don't know why physicians have turned off their critical thinking skills in hospitals, and they're just using this cookbook medicine approach of remdesivir, anemic doses of steroids, and mechanical ventilation. I know it makes them a lot of money, but it's not saving lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for the work you're doing, folks. I know you're too busy to take on more patients, but if people needed to reach out and find you, how do they find you, Jim?
Yeah, you can go to www.meehanmd.com. That's MEEHANMD.com. And listen, I'll just work longer and harder to take care of the patients that need to be taken care of, because that's my calling. That's my duty. You know, I've taken a couple oaths in my lifetime, and one of them's do no harm. It's hard for me to turn a patient away. If they need help, I'll just go without sleep. I'll sleep tomorrow, the weekend. I'll catch up at some point. But I'll get them taken care of, or I'll help them find somebody that will. And there's a lot of us out here that are treating COVID-19. It is treatable. There is hope. And we should always have hope. If we don't have hope, then you can't heal.
Yep. Yep. God bless you, Dr. Jim Meehan. What a blessing you are to this world. You have an amazing
week. You are a blessing too, Paul.
I look forward to talking to you again soon.
I look forward to it too, my brother. God bless you.
God bless you.
Dr. Paul here. Welcome to Against the Wind. I am interviewing PA Scott Miller, and you, my friend, have a story. So we just met. I just got this message from you, and what happened?
Well, I just got a message from the medical board that my license was suspended. I'm no longer allowed to practice medicine in the state of Washington. Because I have been deemed to be a clear and present danger to my patient base and to the community at large because of my early on during this pandemic, I decided that I would, I guess, buck the trend of the CDC saying that there are no treatments, just go home until you're so sick that you end up in the hospital and then you're left to whatever the hospital treatments are.
Right.
And so.
So you've been treating COVID.
I have.
How many patients do you think you've treated?
Adult, about 1,400.
1,400. You've been using a protocol, or I wouldn't even want to call it a protocol. You've been learning as you go with the other organizations that are working like this, right?
Correct.
And what are some of the key treatments that you've found have been helpful? Because you've helped almost 1,400 adults. I think you treated a 100-year-old person. And they're doing fine.
So, you know, the biggest thing was, my message was prophylaxis. You know, what do we know about the virus? Who is it affecting? And it's obviously the elderly, those with pre-existing conditions. And so, you know, what can we do to boost the immune system?
Yeah.
Dr. Schwelt, that does MedCram videos, phenomenal, phenomenal, I think, just information to be able to just learn the why, like why is it that vitamin D is important? You know, what is it that it does to boost our immune system and you know, for preventative or to decrease more acute or severe disease? So my early mission, I started just, I would just scribble notes.
Yeah.
You know, parents would bring their child in for a well child check, and I'm like, so you do know that there are things that we can
do
to decrease risk.
Yeah.
Etc. So there's the CDC guidelines and recommendations, which is fine. I never dissuaded anybody from doing those things.
Sure.
But you can't box a virus in. You know, people are going to the store. They're, you know, they're not wearing their PPE correctly anyway. So so it's, you can't rely on that.
Yeah.
And so I got to a point where it felt so futile telling people one by one.
Right.
When there were so many people that needed this information, that I finally just started openly talking about it, and sharing the information that I had, and I spent, you know, from well, when the shutdown had happened on my birthday, March 12th, when everything went down, and
March
I was
12th of 2020.
Yep. And I was like,
what? Happy birthday and shutdown here.
And the next day, or it was, I think, March 15th, I saw a paper, I think it was out of Italy, and it was talking about the death rate in children 9 and under, and it was basically zero.
Zero, yeah.
And I was fascinated by that. I'm like, how, you know, working through H1N1, where, you know, yep, it was affecting, you know, the younger population, I just, it was this fairly lengthy paper. It was pretty late at night, and I'm like, there's no way I'm gonna read this. And all of a sudden, I just started scrolling through, and it said, melatonin and impact on NLRP3 and inflammasomes and caspase 1. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What is this stuff?
Yeah.
And I just, it was just this switch flip where I was like, that I need to know about this.
Yeah.
Like, this is, it just, it was like the Lord was like, you need to know this information.
I had a friend almost die. I wrote a book within a month, published it in April of 2020. And I was talking about melatonin and zinc and vitamin D and vitamin C, the things that are so easy to do that can be incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
Incredibly helpful. But apparently the powers that be feel like what you're doing with sharing this sort of information is a threat to public health.
According to the documents that I received.
This
yesterday.
Was just last yesterday.
I received it yesterday, yeah.
Wow. Folks, yesterday. And you're here talking to me about it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
What we have going on in this country is when you have a healthcare provider who's helping, I mean, thousands. You also deal with children. You have a big pediatric practice.
I do.
How many children, because I'm a pediatrician, people who know this show know that. How many children in your practice have been hospitalized for COVID, have ended up in the ER for COVID?
Zero.
Zero. That's my same experience.
Yeah.
And the data bears this out. The risk of death from COVID for a child under 19, it's 0.000 something.
You have to have, based on that, there need to be a number of other mitigating factors,
yeah,
that are corresponding to the, so I had a child that had early history of RSV, mm-hmm, respiratory issues and asthmatic, and she got, she was a three-year-old, she got sick, and that was the first time, this was about a month and a half ago, and I was surprised at how quickly she got sick, because typically it's, you know, if they get a fever, it's fever for a day and then it resolves, or,
yeah,
you know, it's mild symptoms, just typical URI type of symptoms, but she actually got sick, and you know, my take on it was, you know, if she had, I don't know if I can say these words, you know, if it was a three-year-old that had scabies or head lice, I would have given her dose-dependent ivermectin to treat it.
Right.
So, and I've used that medication ubiquitously for years,
yeah,
without any issues whatsoever with side,
right,
effects. So, the parents asked if, mm-hmm, I'd be willing to prescribe it, which I did, and I put her on budesonide.
Yeah.
And she was better the next day.
Yeah. So, I wonder if that's partly why you caught the attention of the authorities. There is something crazy going on, folks. I'm sorry, I'm just gonna say it here, right here on the show. The world, across the world, doctors are having incredible success with ivermectin. Its safety record is amazing.
Yep.
But if you speak of it,
yeah,
what happens? This is probably on your list. Did you read your thing? Did they mention ivermectin in there?
The use of non-FDA approved, so these are all FDA approved medications,
right?
So the use of non-FDA approved medications in the use for treating COVID-19. And my initial argument, because this wasn't the first or third or fifth complaint, they started, and none of these complaints are from patients.
Right.
These are people, like I spoke at a school board meeting, and there were people that didn't like what I said.
You know,
I drove up and there, you know, my wife had just been in Texas where people were living fairly normally.
Right.
It's summer, and or you know, end of spring, summer, and I see all these kids outside with masks on out in the playground. And I made the comment. I'm like, what are they doing?
Right.
Like, why are you masking these kids outside while they're running around playing? Like, I need to see the science before we just blanket have everybody do this. Like, how come our school nurses, how come our the doctors that are making these recommendations that the schools are using to determine safety, how come we're not having these conversations with the providers so we can all look at the data and determine, like, is this something that, because I make recommendations for these families.
Right.
And so I think it'd be, instead of them just saying, well, this is the data we have, I'm like, I understand the data you have. I'm just concerned about the data you're choosing to use to determine, you know, these.
So you've caught their attention on the mask issue. You've caught their attention on, you know, you're helping people with things that it's not something that the FDA or Pfizer or Merck is making. You know, heaven forbid you suggest vitamins and maybe off-label use a very beneficial medication like ivermectin that's being used by physicians around the world.
Yeah, and then I accidentally made a statement that I had treated at that time. It was only about 350 patients, but at the time my statement was, you know that there are treatments. Mm-hmm. And I said that to the board, and I said, you know there are treatments. If you took just a couple minutes and just did, even with Google, a basic Google search, right, and you Googled famotidine, mm-hmm. and it would say 70% reduction in hospitalization. If you Google glutathione in COVID, I had an almost argument with a pulmonologist that said that using antioxidants is useless for COVID-19. I'm like, well, let's look at, like, glutathione in COVID-19. It's like, you know, like, low glutathione levels is one of the most, you know, like, common reasons for severe, you know, for severe illness. And it's like, why can you not give that in the hospital?
Yeah.
Why can you not give NAC in the hospital? Yeah. Like, what? Like,
we'll give it for a Tylenol poisoning.
Or alcohol toxicity. Yeah. And so I
can feel your frustration.
Well, when the outcome is death.
Right.
And their protocol has not budged. I had a discussion with an ICU doc, and the wife had a, you know, they had a DNI, and she said, well, you know, what are the next steps? And he said, well, if the oxygen demand becomes too high, at that point we would make him comfortable until he passes. And she had asked if I'd be on the phone to advocate, and I was like, whoa, hold on, he's on supplemental oxygen and 6 milligrams of dexamethasone. He didn't fit the profile for, or they were talking about tocilizumab.
Mm-hmm.
So they're okay doing tocilizumab, which has a high side effect profile, but they won't do, I said, let's look at the data on doing budesonide. Let's look at the data on doing methylprednisolone.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we're using the best data that we have. And I said, okay, if I send you some information, like if I send you data on it, can you take a look at it? And his statement, and this is with the wife on the phone, I don't have the time.
Wow.
I'm like, what?
You're speaking about a hospitalized patient who's potentially going to die.
Correct.
And there are interventions that are well known, well established, they're published. I mean, this stuff is published.
Correct.
It's not just one hearsay doctor talking to another. And they don't have the time.
That was his statement.
Yeah.
I don't have the time. Because I said, I can send you mountains of data on that.
Right.
And he said, I don't have the time. I said, okay, how about I just send you a little bit of data, just something, so that this conversation doesn't have to end with her husband dying.
Yeah.
And I said, you're willing to use tocilizumab, which got emergency use because of its impact on interleukin-6. So there isn't a lot of data on that, right? They kind of picked it as an emergency use. So I said, you know, why don't we take a look at colchicine?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we, like, thiamine? Why don't we do these, you know, like, at least other things that have a low side effect profile. You're worried about using a higher dose steroid because of possible secondary infection. He already had pneumonia that they weren't treating.
Yeah. So just,
but his statement was, well, I'm not a COVID expert. So that was his statement when I was going through, and he's like, well, I'm not a COVID expert.
So you are a COVID expert by the fact that you've treated as many patients as you have. I've talked to several physicians around the country who are treating COVID, and those numbers that you've treated are right up there with other, you know, doctors who are making a huge difference. What's going to happen to your patients if, I mean, you've got a cease and desist. I had that happen to me last December. So you cannot treat a patient today, tomorrow, until this gets hopefully resolved. What happens to your patients?
I mean, so Friday. There's this, the list of people that had called in. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I do peds all day and we see the list and we have our whiteboard, which is like, uh-ohs. Like, okay. Scott, like, you need to get meds out. Like, these are, you know, in between patients, lunch. It's like, this is action plan, getting, you know, Lincare supplemental oxygen where, you know, they're day 8, 9, 10, where, you know, by the time they found out that there are people that would treat, you know, they're in that danger zone. And I remember having that packet sitting on my lap and I'm opening it up and I'm looking at this order from the Attorney General. I was like, and I looked up and I had my schedule open. And I looked up at the board and we have some of them are in red. And I just thought, there's gotta be a way, you know, like, how do I get around this?
Right.
I mean, not like I didn't subvert what happened, but like my brain just, it broke my heart because we know, I mean, 1 or 2 days delay in some of these patients is the literal difference between them ending up in the hospital or being able to get treatments. And
or making it or not.
We know what the data is on hospitals,
right.
And we know what the treatment protocols are, where they go in, they've had fever for 3-4 days, they keep them dry, they put them on Tylenol Q6, so now you're bombing the liver, keep them dry, put them on supplemental oxygen, maybe some Lovenox, and that's it.
It's
as they sit there decompensating.
It's tragic.
As they sit there saying, well, were you vaccinated? No. Well, there was something you could have done to prevent this. That's there. You know, you could have prevented this except for all of the people that call us on day 8 or 9 that have been vaccinated that are still just as sick.
Yeah. Yeah. What, on that note, actually, thank you for sharing that. This is hard stuff. And this is, it's just wrong. We go into medicine to help patients. And I can see that in your heart and your eyes. You just care about patients. You're in the trenches. It's like you're running into the burning building with you know, vitamin C and glutathione and acetylcysteine and vitamin D and ivermectin and whatever is necessary to save people's lives. And now they're going to tell you can't do that. Sorry, we're just going to let those people, they can burn.
When I look at, because it's every day the decisions that I make, and when I say that, I mean none of it was really about me. I mean, I'm a Christian, and pretty much everything that I felt led to do has been driven by my conviction that God had a purpose for me for this time to be able to stand up and help people that came to me. It's like, and in fact, when we were getting more heat and you know, people around me were like, Scott, you've got to shut it down. And I'm like, well, and all of a sudden it's like a friend, right? So somebody's friend got sick. So do I shut it down for them? Like, who's important enough? Mm-hmm. Like, is it because we know them, so we'll treat them? So if it's a stranger, they don't get help.
Right.
And I've told the story, but I remember very late, I'd walk our property and just like, Lord, I don't like help, you know, like, And I remember texting my office manager at like 3 a.m. and I said, listen, if the phones don't ring, you know, if we don't have any phone calls, then all right, let's kind of shut this down. And it from that date, it's been nonstop, and we joke about it that we hear the phone ringing in our nightmares.
Can't turn the phone off.
And we had 22 patients that day, new patients that called in, and my office manager was like, Scott, what did you do? And I was like, I asked what our mission was.
Yeah.
And
well, it's hard to understand right now in this moment. You're just 24 hours from being told you can't practice your trade. You can't help these people in the way you've been helping them. It must feel hopeless. But I'm here to tell you, I've been in your seat, and you're a God man. There is a reason this is happening, and you're going to turn this around for something even bigger and better. But we do have to figure out a way how to rescue your patients.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's crisis 911 stuff. We'll chat off camera and come up with some ideas for that.
Yeah.
COVID is real. I mean, and for people who are at high risk, it's scary,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you've treated very, very sick people. The good news is there's treatment, and there are things you should do to minimize the chances you get it, or if you get it, it's going to be milder because you've done all these things to boost your immune system. This is the information you've been trying to get out to people, but you're also on the 911 team of house calls and you know, really literally saving lives. This is just tragic what the board has done here, folks, and we need to rally. This is a call to action, and we want you, if you're listening to this and this concerns you, join as a member, and we're going to figure out some way to help Scott here and help the people that he's been saving their lives with the work that you've been doing. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, just, there's names that I have on my desk that, it's a messy desk, but your name's been sitting on my, since I saw, I saw the news when I heard what happened to you, and when I told you that, I was so angry, you know, and I just, the level of respect that I have for you and the work that you've done and your advocacy for children and for families, there aren't a lot of people that, I mean, way before me doing this with COVID, you've been doing this for our children.
Those of you who are watching this, who are still living in fear of COVID, you don't need fear of COVID. You need fear of the response to COVID and fear of the treatment you might get in a hospital from doctors who don't have a clue. Sorry, doctors. It's not your fault. It's you're a product of your training, but you need to open your ears, open your eyes, look at the data, look at what's being done. We're having incredible results. You're having incredible results.
Well, and around the world, right?
Around the world, we're having
incredible. Look, I mean, that's Paul, you know, Merrick and Corey, what the FLCCC is doing, and then DeMello and Chetty, and I mean, you know, I've studied these. I consider them these hero doctors around the world that have single-handedly save thousands and thousands and thousands of human beings because they said, I'm not going to go with the status quo.
Yeah.
Because why would you?
Right.
Like the attack on me, one of the main attacks is I'm going against the CDC guidelines, which is do nothing.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's almost, if it wasn't real, there's something so absurd about the idea that somebody would get attacked because there were recommendations that are made to, well, let's look at it. So if you have something that causes, that has a cause, right? Like, I don't cure asthma.
Right.
But if somebody has asthma, there's medications that we can use to mitigate the inflammatory response and help the lungs, right?
Right.
So to say, I don't understand the word asthma, it's new to us, so let's do nothing about it. So they keep using COVID as this novel thing, and because the CDC has a set of checklists, we are somehow bound to be inert on that and do nothing because their checklist doesn't have anything on it.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
So
it doesn't make sense unless you understand conflicts of interest.
Hmm.
So
anyway,
I would like you to look in that camera there and tell the world what you would like them to know, just based on where you're sitting right now.
Wow.
I didn't prepare you for this.
No, sir.
That's okay.
What I know. I mean, COVID is absolutely real. It's devastated our communities. It's devastated our nation in the context of how it's been used to control a narrative and to control us in the context of fear. When you have basically every media outlet suppress information by doctors in our country and around the world that have proven time and time again that there are treatments that successfully mitigate severe outcomes of COVID. Like you have that and it's getting suppressed, and I don't know, it's just I'm just desperate for people to fully wake up and understand that when you're told there's nothing you can do, you should like your brain should start whirling, like what do they mean there's nothing we can do? Like we're just literally just this slave to this, and we just need to literally do exactly what we're told. Stand 6 feet apart, then 3 feet apart. Why? Don't know. Wear your mask there, but when you sit down there, you can take it off. But why? Well, that's just the guideline. And people stopped asking questions. Like, well, explain the guideline. Well, it just is. And if you don't do it, then you're not doing your part. And so you sit there, so they sit there creating all of these policies to separate us, to try and divide us. And it's like I don't want to be divided from my community. Like, I want to educate my community. I want to help and treat anyone that comes to me. And, you know, if I say something that seems off, right, if I make a recommendation, then I tell somebody to vet it. Like if I say, you know, whatever the disease state is, like if somebody's like, well, that doesn't make sense, can you explain it? I better be able to do it like that. And if I say, well, because it's on a checklist, you better go somewhere else. We've become this where we just are just obeying. We're not questioning. We're not asking. And it's scary to me. And so I'm just, you know, I'm so grateful and thankful for our community, for Washougal and Camas, the families there that have been so supportive. It's just, I'm just grateful for them. Just for all of y'all, you know, you're just for trusting me and believing in me and knowing that from the beginning, my only goal is to be able to serve my community the best that I can. And it breaks my heart right now to know that there are people in my community that I'm not able to be able to serve at this time, but we're working right now. And there's people tirelessly working on finding other ways outside of me to be able to stop, you know, to plug that hole for people that are sick so that they can still get the treatment that they deserve.
Yeah. COVID is treatable. It's largely preventable by boosting your immune system with a whole host of natural ways. And if you are suffering from it or you have a loved one who's suffering from it, get treatment. Find a doctor like this incredible clinician who knows what they're doing. And they're out there, they're few and far between, and they are under attack. You are under attack for messing with their narrative that this is a dangerous disease, we need to all live in fear, go to your corners, wear your masks, et cetera, et cetera. When we have stadiums full of 80,000 people screaming and yelling and high-fiving and drinking their beer or whatever they're doing, no super spreader events in those stadiums in certain states where they don't have the same rules. So we have some disconnect here, folks. But this thing is also real, and it's also scary, and you've seen the scary face of this, and you're running into those burning buildings. So thank you for doing that, and I wish you the best outcome for what's coming ahead. I know God's not going to leave you alone. There's some major purpose that you're supposed to be now focusing on after we get the hole plugged. Thank you for coming on the show.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Paul here. Doctorsandscience.com is where you go to get access to my exclusive members-only section. This is how you, the viewers, support our work. We have no sponsors. We are fully supported by you, our viewers. What do you get in the members section? It's quite a list. You get access to a couple of my ebooks. The first one is the authoritative reference list for my Vaccine Friendly Plan book. I also have written a book, very extensive, called Everyday Health, that covers pretty much what I think you should be doing if you want to live a healthy life in this world today. But there's so much more. We have a live Q&A every week after the show with yours truly, Dr. Paul, answering your questions. Submit your questions online and I will tackle as many of them as I possibly can and try to answer to the best of my ability whatever burning questions you have. In addition to this, you get transcripts of every show. We have other bonus content, and I think one of the huge bonus content pieces is the PowerPoints of the talks I'm giving as I travel around the country. People are always asking me, how can we get those PowerPoints? This is how you do it. Head on over to doctorsandscience.com and become a member and join the team of Against the Wind. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com. Sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.